Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is June 21st, 2017, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is We Weren't Born to Follow Up, the PYTHO Long-Term Follow-Up Study. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Kirsty Chalin. Kirsty is a consultant in emergency medicine at Lancashire. I practice that a lot, by the way. Teaching Hospital Trust, Northwest England. She did her medical school at Manchester with a history of medicine BSc at the same time. Kirsty did her residency in Northwest England and has a PhD in health services research from Sheffield. Wow. Talk about qualified. Welcome back to the SGM, Kirsty.
Hi, Ken. Good to be back.
That's a lot of reading. You are highly edumacated.
I get bored easily.
Well, you have your own knowledge translation project called Paper and a Pick. Can you explain what that means to the SGEMers?
So I take an academic paper that's already been examined by the SGEM, and then I summarize the results of it in a single infographic. Now, obviously, I can't put more than the results on the infographic. So people should always read the paper and they should always listen to the SGEM for their skeptical thinking.
And they should be always skeptical of anything they hear, or in this case, see, even if they heard it from Paper and a Pick or the SGEM. So how did you fall into making infographics of papers?
Well, when I was revising for my FRChem exam, which is like boards for British people, I really struggled with all the lists I had to learn. So I came up with lots of mnemonics, but then I couldn't remember which mnemonic was for which list. So I had to start drawing pictures for myself to tie the list to the mnemonic, and I got kind of hooked on drawing pictures. So once I passed the exam, I wanted something else to make the pictures for, and it all kind of grew from there.
And it all came together. Paper and a pick. I like it. You know, people may not appreciate this, but I'm listening to you and you sound a little stuffy, even with an accent.
Thank you for pointing out that the pollen levels in my part of England at the moment are somewhere in the stratosphere.
No, I think they're not in the stratosphere. I think they're in your nose.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to see the paper and a picks done by Kirsty on the SGEM, just click on the link in the show notes and you'll find Paper and a Pick. There's one other thing I wanted to mention, Kirsty. Did you know that this is the last one of the SGEM for season number 5?
No.
Yes, yes. Well, I have an SGEM hop that falls in July, but I usually like to take July and August off for, you know, getting ready for the next season, putting out some extra content and stuff. But this is going to be the last one, number 184 for the SGEM.
Oh, no. I hope you'll be having some SGEM extras to keep us going.
Oh, this summer? Oh,
now, yeah.
Now, I already... Okay, I told you. Is this thing on? Is this thing on? I don't know if anybody else is listening. But I'm going to be doing a special series this summer called... Wait for it. Wait for it. Legends of Emergency Medicine. Yes, I'm going to be interviewing a number of legends, well, people that I think are legends that inspired me about emergency medicine, their background, what they're most proud of, and where they see emergency medicine in the future. So stay tuned. You won't have to get bored, Kirsty. There will be more SGEM even through the summer.
That's fantastic.
All right, enough blah, blah, blah. Let's talk about a case.
Okay, so... A 22-year-old patient presents to your emergency department with sudden-onset shortness of breath. She takes the oral contraceptive pill and was placed in a below-knee plaster cast for a fibula fracture 2 weeks ago. She's alert and talking with a systolic blood pressure of 110. But CTPA demonstrates bilateral pulmonary artery thrombus with right ventricular dilatation and her troponin's raised. When he explained this to her, she asked if there isn't something she could have to break up the clot.
Well, we've discussed pulmonary embolism a number of times on the SGEM. In episode 51 and 126, we talked about managing some patients with PEs at home. Then in episode 163, we shuffled off to Buffalo and discussed ultrasound-facilitated, catheter-directed, low-dose fibrinolysis for acute, massive, or submassive PEs.
And the 2015 CHESS guidelines recommend systemically administered thrombolytic therapy in patients with acute PE associated with hypotension. That's a systolic blood pressure of less than 90 millimeters of mercury who don't have a high risk of bleeding.
Yeah, they say in their quote, in patients with acute PE associated with hypotension, and like you said, systolic blood pressure less than 90, who do not have a high bleeding risk, we suggest systemically administered thrombolytic therapy over no such therapy. And they give that a grade 2B.
And in addition, this guideline still suggests systemic thrombolytic therapy using a peripheral vein over catheter-directed thrombolysis, or CDT, in patients with acute PE treated with thrombolytic agents. They do note that patients with a higher risk of bleeding who have access to CDT are likely to choose CDT over systemic thrombolytic therapy.
Yeah, they say, quote, in patients with acute PE who are treated with a thrombolytic agent, we suggest systemic thrombolytic therapy using a peripheral vein over catheter-directed thrombolysis. And they give that a grade 2C recommendation.
But they add in their remarks, patients who have a higher risk of bleeding with systemic thrombolytic therapy who have access to the expertise and resources required to do CDT are likely to choose CDT over systemic thrombolysis.
However, we've been left with not sure what to do about submassive PE. Hence, the highly memorable Swami versus Birdsall cage match at SmackDub.
Oh yes, I still haven't recovered from Ian trying to rap. Anyway, previous trials have suggested a reduction in clinical compensation, that's the MAPIT 3 trial, and long-term pulmonary hypertension, the MOPIT trial, in patients who are given systemic thrombolytics.
The largest trial to date was the pulmonary embolism thrombolysis trial published in the New England Journal of Medicine 2014. It showed an NNT of 33 to prevent death or hemodynamic decompensation in the first 7 days, but an NNH of 11 for major bleeding.
So the authors of that trial, the PYTHO trial, conclude in patients with intermediate risk pulmonary embolism, fibrinolytic therapy prevented hemodynamic compensation, but increased the risk of major hemorrhage and stroke.
So Kirsty, what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer today?
Does systemic thrombolysis in patients with submassive PE improve long-term mortality or morbidity?
And what's the reference? Oh, and I'm glad you get to read this name because you know what I'm like.
It's Konstantinides et al. The impact of thrombolytic therapy on the long-term outcome of intermediate risk pulmonary embolism. And that's published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology in March 2017.
And this is the long-term follow-up of around 71% of the patients recruited to the PYTHO study. All right, let's run through that PICO, the population, the intervention, the comparison, and the outcome. What was the population?
So it was adult patients with objectively confirmed acute PE within 15 days of their first symptoms. They needed to have right ventricular dysfunction on echo or CT chest and a myocardial injury by positive troponin I or T.
There were a number of exclusion criteria, and I'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
It was a single weight-based IV bolus of tenecteplase, which ended up being in the dose of range of 30 to 50 milligrams.
And what did they compare it to?
A placebo of a bolus matched for appearance and volume, and all patients in both arms received unfractionated heparin.
All right, let's go through the outcomes. What was the primary outcome?
The primary outcome was long-term mortality.
And how about the secondary outcomes?
Persistent symptoms of heart failure and echo findings.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, approximately 33% of patients report some degree of persistent functional limitation after intermediate risk PE. But CTEPH is infrequent. Thrombolytic treatment did not affect long-term mortality rates, and it did not appear to reduce residual dyspnea or RV dysfunction in these patients. End of quote. Kirsty, you know we have a quality checklist for randomized clinical trials, and this one has 11 questions in this checklist, so let's run through those. The first question, are we talking about or focused on ED patients?
Not sure, but the inclusion criteria they used would match the patients we see in the ED.
Did they adequately randomize these patients?
Yes.
Did they conceal the randomization?
Yes, they had a central computerized randomization.
And the patients, did they analyze them in the groups to which they were randomized?
They did. They did an intention to treat analysis.
Was it consecutive recruitment?
Not sure, but there isn't any mention of convenient sampling or restricted hours.
The patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes.
Were all participants unaware of group allocation, so blinding?
Well, yes and then no. Initially, they were blinded to the group allocation. But when the authors wrote up their short-term findings in the 2014 paper, the concealment code was broken.
All right. Were all groups treated equally except for the intervention?
Yeah.
And how about follow-up? Was it complete?
No and yes again. So not all of the original sites participated in the two-year follow-up. So only 70% of the entire study population was included in that. But of that 71%, they got 98% follow-up for mortality, not quite as much for the secondary outcomes.
And were all patient-important outcomes considered?
Yes.
And how about question 11, the treatment effect? Was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No, it wasn't.
All right, let's run through those key results. As stated previously, they were able to only recruit about 71% of the entire study population consented to obtain two-year survival data and prospectively conduct long-term clinical follow-up and echo follow-up of their patients.
The mean age was about 67 years, with just over 50% being female.
All right, so what was the primary outcome?
There was no difference in all-cause or cause-specific long-term mortality.
Yeah, so when they looked at mortality, they had 20% in the treatment group versus 18% in the placebo group. This gave you a p-value of 0.43, and it was not statistically significant. How about the secondary outcomes?
We can put all the details in the show notes, but effectively, there was no difference statistically or clinically in the secondary outcomes.
All right, Kirsty, time to talk a little nerdy. One of my favorite sections. All right, so let's run through 5 points. Go figure, 5 points. And talk about how they could threaten the validity of the study.
Okay, so were these emergency department patients? Well, from the paper, this isn't clear. But we reached out to Prof. Konstantinidis, who confirmed this, and I quote, "The vast majority of the PYTHO patients were recruited in emergency departments. Although this type of information wasn't explicitly requested in the ECRF, their clinical report form, and thus not directly obtained, we showed in the original NEJM paper in 2014 that only 6% of the patients had surgery in the previous month. Of those, only a small minority were actually still in the hospitalised in the same hospital in which surgery was performed. Clearly, most surgical patients were excluded because they had, or at least considered to have, contraindications to thrombolysis. We also had no medically ill patients who suffered acute PE in the same hospital in which they were admitted for an acute disease," end of quote.
So you reached out to the lead author and got him to respond?
Yeah, he was very helpful.
Excellent initiative. I love it when we get deeper understanding of the paper. Well done. All right, so number two was consecutive recruitment. This is often a problem in emergency medicine research. If you only recruit at convenient times, like daylight hours, it is possible that you get a different patient group. This could introduce bias and limit external validity. Patients who get out of bed to see us at 4 a.m. may be sicker or different than those who wait till morning. It isn't explicitly stated in either the PYTHO paper or the methodology paper, but there isn't any mention of convenient sampling or restricted research hours.
That's right. Talk nerdy number three, allocation blinding. This was really well done in the initial paper with a placebo that matched to Nectarplase and blinding throughout the research team. However, the authors broke the allocation code when they were writing up the initial paper in 2014, so it's possible that the researchers at the centres who did long-term clinical and echocardiographic assessment knew which group the patient was in. But this would tend to inflate any benefit of the treatment, which makes it less of an issue given the results they had.
All right, nerdy point number four, completeness of follow-up. And this is one of the big things here. It's a mixed bag. Initially, just over 1,000 patients were randomized. The 28 sites which plan to do long-term follow-up randomized 709 of those patients. So you get 71%. Now, they did get good follow-up on mortality, 98%. However, clinical assessment was done only in 356 of the 578 long-term survivors. So that's 62%. And echoes are down to only 50%. And this could seriously affect the validity of the results.
It could. At a worst case, maybe all the missing patients in the intervention group could have done really well and they didn't come to clinic because they were busy skiing across Antarctica. And all those in the placebo group were so breathless they couldn't even get to the clinic. Now, we're going to put a table in the show notes, but that could leave you with 63 patients who had to neck to place who had symptoms and all the missing ones with no symptoms, plus all the missing placebo ones in the symptom group. And then you'd get 21% with symptoms in the treatment arm and 57 in the placebo arm. That's not the same result as the paper.
All right. The fifth and final point is a priori. Funny that we're putting a priori as the last thing. Well, this is another threat to the validity of the study, and it is often a problem with outcomes that weren't considered before the study was started. Ideally, we like to see a pre-planned study powered for long-term outcomes, which is resourced to carry out long-term assessments on all the patients who are randomized.
Exactly. Unfortunately, the UK National Funding Network, the NIHR, has recognised this, and they've just issued a call for projects to look at exactly this. We'll put the link up on the blog site.
All right, now it's time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
And generally, we agree with the author's conclusions.
Yes, we generally do. How about a bottom line?
So thrombolysis in submassive PE can't be recommended to reduce long-term mortality or morbidity at this time.
So what are you going to do with that case you presented?
The patient is going to be treated with low molecular weight heparin, admitted to a high care area so that thrombolysis can be reconsidered if she deteriorates.
And so how are you going to take this information, Kirsty, and apply it clinically?
At the moment, in patients with submassive PE, I'm going to treat them with low molecular weight heparin until there's a trial and I can recruit them to a well-designed trial of thrombolysis.
And what are you going to tell the patient who asked you, isn't there something that can bust up this clot?
I'm going to say, although it sounds sensible to give you a drug to break up the clot, the evidence that we have at the moment is that it won't improve your survival or how well you are in the long term. We might need to reconsider that if your blood pressure drops.
There are some other FOMED resources on this, and I'll put links in the show notes. It's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was David Hedman. He knew the first nationally recognized curriculum for EMS was published in 1969. What's the Keener contest question this week?
This week's question, which physician, more famous for a triad, first recognized that clots in the pulmonary artery originate in the venous system?
Well, if you know the answer, then send me an email at thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. And the first correct answer will receive the last cool skeptical prize from season number 5. Thank you, Kirsty, for being such a great guest skeptic.
Thank you, Ken. It's been a pleasure.
So when can we expect the paper and a picture for this episode?
Well, it depends how long you take to do the editing, but I'm hoping the picture might be ready at the same time.
Ooh, at the same time. Well, until then, can you give the SGEM tagline in that accent you have that's all stuffed up?
Remember, be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time. We weren't born.